And welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today, my guest is Chris Bojalian. Chris is the author of 9 novels, including his latest, Before You Know Kindness, put out by Shea Earhart Books just this month, as well as his collection of essays, Idle Banter. He won the New England Book Award in 2002. His novel, Midwives, was a number one New York Times bestseller, a selection of Oprah's Book Club, a Publisher's Weekly Best Book, and a New England Bestsellers Association Discovery Pick. His work has been translated into 17 languages, been published in 20 countries, and twice become acclaimed movies, Midwives and Past the Bleachers. The Buffalo Soldier, The Law of Similars, and Water Witches are all in development for movies as well. He's written for a wide variety of magazines, including Cosmopolitan, Reader's Digest, and the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and he's been a columnist for Gannett's Burlington Free Press since 1992. Hello there.
Barbara, you make me sound so gosh darn impressive.
I know, you are so gosh darn impressive. Well, oh my gosh.
Well, so are you. Congratulations on Pen on Fire, which is a wonderful, wonderful book you wrote.
Oh, well, thank you. That's
you bet.
Very
that
nice
is just
of you.
A terrific source for all writers.
Oh, thank you. That's sweet of you. But we're here to talk about you, not me, and your wonderful new book, Before You Know Kindness. Once again, it seems like you can do no wrong, really. This book is another family drama that revolves around animal activism and gun control. And I am so curious where it came from, what the genesis of this book was.
Yeah, there's a short answer and there's a long answer. The short answer is I wanted to write a big, sprawling family saga with characters you cared passionately about and wanted to spend a lot of time with, and the Godzilla-sized mistakes that parents are capable of making raising their children. Here's the long answer, though. Clearly, this book had been inside me, this big, sprawling family saga. On September 11th, 2001, I was on a runway at Denver International Airport at 7:15 Mountain Time, 9:15 in the East. Obviously, our plane never took off. I returned to my hotel, and I spent the next 7 days trapped in a hotel in Denver with a manuscript for a novel I was writing. I would pull myself away from the horrors on television. So I would stop listening to the radio, and I would work on this book. When I finally returned to Vermont on September 20th, I sat down with a manuscript, and I looked at it, and I was miserable. Every time I went near that particular novel, I was depressed and saddened. And back in September of 2001, we had no idea what the immediate or long-term future was going to hold. And so I decided on September 21 to stop writing the novel and start something completely new. So I boxed up the manuscript. I was about halfway done. All my notes, all the books that I bought about the subject, and I put it in one of those big banker boxes and shipped it down to my college archives where my papers are preserved. And then the next day, I started a brand new novel, and it's a novel that would become Before You Know Kindness. And I began with the happiest image I could think of that day. And that image was something I'd witnessed earlier that summer in July of 2001 when I was watching my daughter, who at the time would have been, oh gosh, 7, and my niece from New York City, who would have been 8, sitting on the wraparound porch on my mother-in-law's big house in New Hampshire talking about birds. And I just loved listening to my mother-in-law, these girls' grandmother, and these two wonderful girls bonding and chatting and talking. The sky was cerulean blue. It was one of those crisp, magnificent early summer mornings in the White Mountains of New Hampshire when the world is perfect. And so that is the very first scene I wrote of the book. And it is the scene that you'll recognize, Barbara, that is in chapter one.
Yes.
Of Before You Know Kindness.
Yes.
Now, of course, books are organic. They grow. They change. And once I began to understand who these fictional girls were, who were based on my daughter and my niece, I began to think about who their parents were. And all of a sudden, I had a great conflict in mind. One of the girls was going to be from Vermont, as my daughter was from, and one of the girls was going to be from New York City, where my niece hails from. But imagine if the Vermont girl's father happened to be a deer hunter and the New York City girl's father happened to be a animal rights activist for a fictional version of PETA. What kind of great conflict could emerge? What might cause the uneasy truce that a hunter and an animal rights activist have? What might make that truce go to hell in a handbasket? So I started pushing that notion of a conflict around, and in 2002 and 2003, I wrote the book that is Before You Know Kindness, that big, sprawling family saga propelled forward by a tragic gun accident that now occurs on page one of the novel involving a girl on the cusp of adolescence and her dad. So the book isn't nearly as happy as I thought it might have been on September 20th, 2001. But I also don't think it's an especially dark book. I think it's a page-turner. I think it's a gently comic novel at points about family and food. And how amazing, the amazingly bad jobs that we parents can do, even with the very best of intentions.
Well, tell me, how did you come up with this conflict? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, it sounded like you had characters and you had a setting and you kind of had a feeling about it, but then you have this terrific conflict between the two men and sort of their perspectives or their lifestyles.
You know, the book is not autobiographic, but it is rich with autobiographic minutia, and much of that autobiographic minutia led to the conflict. For example, I am a vegetarian. I'm not the fanatical animal rights activist that the fictional Spencer McCullough is in the novel, but just as Spencer McCullough became a vegetarian because he cleavered one too many live lobsters while working as a seafood chef in a restaurant, I did too. When I was 18 and 19 years old, I was lobster boy at this horrible restaurant in northern New Hampshire that specialized in steak and something called a baked stuffed lobster. I started that summer as the lowly dishwasher, but thanks to pluck and luck and the fact that the seafood chef was arrested for cocaine possession, I was abruptly promoted to seafood chef, and our specialty was the baked stuffed lobster, so I had to learn how to cleaver into a live lobster quickly, stuff it, bake it, serve it. And I was so good at this that all of these, you know, these very experienced waiters who, you know, now I know they were only in their 20s and 30s, but at the time they seemed to me, you know, these very established, powerful men, they called me Lobster Boy, and they knew how good I was at this. And whenever a bus tour would pull into the restaurant, they would all, as if they were a chorus, recommend to everyone the baked stuffed lobster. So some nights I would be cleavering 40 and 50 live lobsters a night. I was a lobster killing machine. And so that was one of the things that drove me toward vegetarianism. A simple repulsion to what I was doing, a revulsion to meat, and probably some sort of, you know, karmic guilt, fear that there's some sort of great, you know, lobster payback waiting for you. Anyway, and so that's, and there's a line in the book that I think more than any led me to this particular conflict. The matriarch of this big brood that descends upon her house in New Hampshire, the whole extended family, is Nan Seton. And Nan Seton is a very vigorous embodiment of my mother-in-law. And because I'm a vegetarian, and because my wife is a vegetarian, and because our daughter is a vegetarian, she considers us very difficult eaters. And when there were 15 or 20 people gathered at the house, and there were the three vegetarians, she finds it really pretty onerous. And so there's a line in the novel in which Nancy Eaton says to a friend of hers on the telephone early in the book, as her vegetarian son-in-law and daughter and granddaughter are about to arrive, "Oh, they're just such difficult eaters. That's the hard part of having them." And that's something, you know, I've heard my mother-in-law say many times, and I think on some level that is what inspired the notion of this conflict.
Interesting.
Food.
Yes. Well, what's also interesting about it is that, you know, in sort of dealing with this issue, is that you don't preach or you don't, you know, weigh too heavily on, you know, with vegetarian views, or, you know, the other side gets its due and its say as well, so that, you know, you can really see all sides of the story here.
You know, I hope so. I hope, I've heard from people on both sides of the animal rights issue in the last 2 weeks since this book came out, and they've all really loved it. They've loved the book, they've loved the satire, and I think they've understood that if I am decrying anything, I am decrying self-righteous fanaticism.
Yes.
I mean, certainly the hunters get their comeuppance, some of the animal rights activists get their comeuppance. I received one letter that I thought was really, really interesting, in which this person is clearly an animal rights activist. Anyway, and what she said is that she felt that some of the animal rights activists seemed a little too quirky, but how could you disagree with anything they said?
Right.
And I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, that's excellent. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here with Chris Bojalian, author of Before You Know Kindness, published by Shea Earhart Books, just out this month. Earlier you said that you packed up that one novel you were working on and shipped it off, I guess, to Amherst?
That's right.
And started this book. And you've said that before, that you will just abandon a novel if no matter how far into it you are, because if you're bored, you assume the reader will be bored, and you feel that it's unfair to put a reader through it.
Yes, that's exactly right. I do feel that way.
Talk about that, because so many writers start projects and feel that because they've started them, because they are in 100 pages, 50 pages even, that they must continue.
Yep. I once heard, or maybe I read somewhere, an entrepreneur talking about that the greatest strength an entrepreneur can have is the courage to cut bait when something isn't working. And as a novelist, a couple of times I have cut bait when I have been extremely invested in a novel, emotionally and fiscally. But, you know, there's a reality as a novelist that if I spend 6 months or 9 months working on a book and then decide not to finish that book, that 6 to 9 months of time that is lost and salary that is lost, in essence. But I've also come to the conclusion that it is an even more egregious and dangerous bit of career suicide to finish a book that isn't working or finish a book that you don't care passionately about than it is to get it out there because you've spent 6 to 9 months on it. Chances are you're going to hurt your literary legacy far more by publishing that book you don't care about, and you're going to hurt your literary reputation far more by publishing that book you don't care about than by biting the bullet and saying, this is a dead end, I need to turn around, go back down the alley, and start again, and accept the fact that I've got to move on. And I've never regretted that decision. All of those books that I didn't finish for one reason or another, I have no desire to go back to them. Some people, I'm 43 years old, and some people say, oh my goodness gracious, he's written 9 books in a collection of essays, he's really, really prolific. And sometimes I laugh and say, no, 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 I just have very low standards. But, but you know, but the reality is I do have standards, and I am prolific, not because I've published 9 novels, but because I've published 9 novels and there are at least 3 or 4 other books that I got between 75 and 200 pages into, and I chose not to finish them.
So will you finish a novel before your editor sees it?
No. I will usually, when I have between 75 and 125 pages, show it to my editor, show it to my wife, see what the two of them think of it, where they think it's going, what excites them about it, what doesn't excite them about it, and then I will make some decisions about how to proceed. And usually I give myself 2 or 3 weeks off once I've got to that 75 to 125 page stage, so I can let the ideas germinate, and while my wife and my editor are reading the book, the ideas can just be fallow, and we'll see what happens after I talk to them about it.
Interesting. Will you read to us?
I would be happy to.
And if you just tuned in, again, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here with Chris Bojalian, author of Before You Know Kindness.
And I'm going to start at the beginning, and I'm going to read you a little bit of the prologue of Before You Know Kindness. And then I can, perhaps in the second half hour, if you'd like, read part of the first chapter.
Okay.
Okay. The bullet, cylindriform as a rocket, but tapering to a point almost sharp enough to prick skin with a casual touch, was 2.5 inches long when it was in its cartridge in the rifle. The shank was made of copper, and the expansion chamber would cause it to double in diameter upon impact. The tip was designed to swell upon contact as well, ripping apart the flesh and muscle and bone as it made its way to the elk's or the bear's or, most likely, the deer's heart. It looked like a little missile. The bullet did not hit Spencer McCullough in the chest that very last night in July, however, because that would have killed him pretty near instantly. Nor did it plunge into his abdomen, which, depending upon how much of his stomach, his liver, and his spleen were in harm's way, would have killed him over the course of minutes. A .30-06, a .30-caliber bullet atop the classic cartridge case developed by the U.S. Army in 1906, turns bowels into pudding. Instead, it ripped into the man's body just above and to the side of his chest, slamming into him below his right shoulder. It shattered completely the scapula and his shoulder joint, demolished his rotator cuff, which would have been even more debilitating for his wife, Catherine, because she still gave a damn about her tennis serve, and mixed into a thick, sloppy soup the muscles that Spencer used to move his shoulder and lift his right arm. The bullet was traveling at 2.5 times the speed of sound, and the tissue had to absorb the velocity. Consider the way a bullet does not appear to pierce a brick of jello, but rather causes it to explode. What was of most importance to the two EMTs who arrived at the house at the very peak of Sugar Hill, New Hampshire, however, was that the bullet had also obliterated the first branch of the axillary artery, the superior thoracic artery. Though as they were taking what remained of Spencer's vitals near what remained of his snow peas that summer night in the garden, they tended not to use words like axillary and thoracic. They used words like bleeder and terms like bleeding out, and Evan Seaver, the male of the pair, allowed himself a small assortment of expletives and invectives. Still, Spencer McCullough was alive. And if someone had said to either Missy Fearon or Evan Seaver before they arrived at the house on Sugar Hill that a guy there had taken a bullet from a .30-06 a couple of inches from his heart, they both would have assumed that they could have driven from the scene to the hospital at the speed limit. Only when they had deposited Spencer at the hospital and he had been rushed into the OR did either of them have the time to voice the questions that had crossed both their minds. Why the hell was there a loaded deer rifle on the property 3.5 months before hunting season? And why in the name of heaven was a 12-year-old kid, the guy's own daughter, Charlotte for God's sake, firing pot shots into the garden on the last night of July? And that is from the prologue of Before You Know Kindness.
Oh, thank you so much. That was Chris Bojalian reading. And curious, at what point did you write this prologue? Did it come at the beginning of the project, at the end?
This came about a quarter of a way through the book. I had probably written about 120 or 125 pages, and these two girls, Willow Seaton from Vermont and Charlotte McCullough from New York City, who are 10 and 12 respectively, have just gone to a party with some older kids at a swim club, in a golf club, on a summer night in July, and the older kids are smoking a little dope and drinking beer, and, well, Charlotte, who's 12 and wants to be older than 12, like many 12-year-olds, finds herself smoking a joint and drinking a beer, and, well, before she knows it, she's home, she's a little tipsy, she gets a hold of her uncle's hunting rifle, and hears something at the edge of the garden, and, well, she's going to teach her dad a lesson because, you know, he's an animal rights activist, and so she's never been allowed to own a leather skirt or leather shoes or go to McDonald's. Her father is always that crazy man arguing with Katie Couric and Harry Smith in the morning. And so she decides she's going to take out a deer. And, well, instead of blowing off a deer, she blows off her father's right arm. And so once I knew that that happened, I thought, you know, this is a great place to begin the book. And I went back and wrote the prologue, of which I just read you the first two or three and the last two or three paragraphs.
Yeah. Well, also, your books, of course, this one included, always have this great dramatic movement throughout, you know, that pretty much from the beginning, we know we're headed for trouble, and we're curious, of course, how we get into this trouble and then how we're going to get out. But is that something that's pretty much thought out before you begin? Do you need to know the dramatic arc of the story before you start writing?
I'd be a much better writer if I did. When I start a book, I have a vague premise, and this book was no exception. It's probably the most vague premise I've ever had. I wanted to write a book that was going to be nothing like the book I was writing in Denver. So I began with this happy image. Then as it grew, I realized it had something to do with animal rights and hunting and fanaticism. But I had no idea that Charlotte was going to shoot off her father's right arm. Hadn't a clue. Which is probably one of the reasons why I rewrite so copiously. All my books go through 7 or 8 drafts. And I think part of that is because almost in the way a reader discovers and is surprised by what happens next and what happens next and what happens next, I'm surprised always by what happens next and what happens next.
So the ending, I mean, there's quite a twist toward the end. Actually, the climax of the story, you didn't know you were headed to that place?
No. There are a couple of conflicts in this book that I had no idea how they would be resolved. Conflict number one, Spencer and Charlotte McCullough's marriage when the book opens is not in tatters, but it's in jeopardy. Spencer, the rights activist, is this self-absorbed fanatic. His wife has become this secret militant meat eater behind his back. They're both so obsessed with their own problems and lives that they are oblivious to some of the trouble that their daughter, who's 12 and almost 13, is about to get into. So that was one conflict in my mind. Will Spencer and Catherine be married at the end of the book, or will they be separated? The second conflict is about Spencer and his daughter, Charlotte. They're not estranged as fathers and daughters go, but, you know, they're not as close as they once were. Will this accident push them further apart, or will it bring them together? And then I realized, here's a big one. Is Charlotte going to forgive herself, or is Charlotte's life forever ruined because of the fact she crippled her father for life, nearly killed the guy? And then, of course, opposite all of the problems confronting this New York family are the smaller problems confronting the Vermont family, beginning with the fact that John Seaton, the hunter, had left a cartridge in his rifle because he was such a neophyte, he hadn't known how to eject it when it jammed, and he was taking it to a gunsmith, but he hadn't gotten around to doing it yet, and so he was sitting in the trunk of his car exactly where his niece would find it that tragic summer evening. So he's wrestling with a lot of guilt. And then, of course, There's my absolute favorite character in the book, 10-year-old Willow Seton, who she might be my favorite character I've ever created, who is with her older cousin when they're smoking dope and drinking the beer, and who knows something that no one else on the planet but her cousin knows, and her cousin certainly isn't going to tell anyone, and that is this, that Charlotte was stoned when she shot her father, a detail that matters for myriad reasons, not the least of which is this. Spencer's animal rights organization is suing the gun manufacturer, not with any hope of winning, but just with the plan of getting lots and lots and lots of visibility for anti-hunting, for their anti-hunting, pro-animal rights agenda. If the world knows that Charlotte was stoned, there can be no lawsuit, and thus Charlotte can't even allow her father to have this one opportunity to capitalize on his injury. And so that was another conflict. I had no idea how any of these would resolve themselves, and some of them resolved themselves in a good way, and some of them resolved themselves in a horrible way. I only say that because I don't want to reveal the ending for readers who might be listening. I love this book. I will never write a book this good again as long as I live. This is
it. Every time, though, you seem to come up with a new one. So I can't imagine that not being true, although I love this book, too, and I really loved how it resolved, how it ended, and it for all the drama going on in the book, it just, you know, it left me as a reader in a place where I wish your next one was coming right out, you know? I mean, that's what you want, I think, at the end of a book. You want to pick up the next one.
Oh, thank you, Ellen. Thank you.
So, and now I have to wait. I have to wait, or I have to go back and reread some of the ones I've read. So, okay, I'll just wait.
The next one will be actually in 2 years from now. It's supposed to come out in October of 2006.
That seems so long.
It does.
Well,
this is the longest I've ever gone between novels. This is almost 3 years since The Buffalo Soldier was published. It doesn't seem that long, I guess, because the Buffalo Soldier paperback came out, and then I did that collection of magazine essays and newspaper columns, Idle Banter. But this was almost 3 years in the making, this one.
Interesting. Well, don't go away. We're going to be right back. And all of you out there, don't you go away either. We will be back in just a couple of minutes with more Chris Bohjalian, and he'll read to us again. So please, stay put.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One bed a day, let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I am Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. And before we go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. I'm here today with Chris Bojalian, author of Before You Know Kindness, published by Shea Earhart Books. Hi there.
Good evening.
You know, you talk so eloquently and articulately about the book, and you're, gosh, I mean, you go so into depth, and I'm wondering if you think that a writer needs to be able to reduce a book once, either before they've written it or after, to a one-line sentence, almost like a movie pitch. Do you think that that's a necessity to be able to just, you know, you're at a cocktail party, a movie producer is there, says, what's your book about? And you tell him or her and, you know, a few words.
I don't think you need to be able to do a Hollywood flyover of your novel to be a good writer. I think if you can do a Hollywood flyover of your novel, it helps. And I don't mean it just helps your career, because, you know, when you're on for 4.5 minutes on the Today Show or the early show on CBS, you can explain it crisply and succinctly, but because when you're talking to readers about it, you can give them an honest sense of whether it's something they want to read. I mean, and I always do think of these things. For example, if we were only going to be on for 90 seconds, I would say, Before You Know Kindness is about three generations of women and, yeah, the dysfunctional men in their lives. But because we have the luxury of talking for more than that, I can babble on forever and ever about all the things I really, really love about the book in terms of Willow and the dynamics of food and the dynamics of the garden and all of those conflicts that we spent a few moments talking about just before the break.
That's good. I mean, that's a good way of explaining it, actually.
Yeah.
I would think, too, being able to talk about your book succinctly means that you know what you're writing about, that it's, you know, it's thought out, it's there on the paper, as opposed to just, you know, a lot of ideas.
Yes, you know, I think that's absolutely right, and I think that's absolutely fair too, that maybe if you're not quite ready to distill the book down to its essence, you haven't figured out its essence and you've got some work to do.
You also write women so well. This novel has a number of point of view characters, many of whom are female. Talk about that. I mean, you just are very much in the female psyche in this book, as well as men, of course. But has it always been that way for you, or you just pay attention?
I do, and there's an irony to that, because I often feel like I'm one of those guys who doesn't quite get it. I grew up in a household of men. Our family was so, you know, I had no sisters, and the family was so determinedly male, led by my wonderful but extremely patriarchal father, that we weren't even allowed to have cats because they were perceived as too feminine a pet for boys, and all of the dogs had to be male. And then I married into this family of women. My wife is one of four sisters, no brother. Dad disappeared in divorce way back in 1967 when she was really, really young. And so it was it was a family of women that I was marrying into, and they certainly keep me humble. Now, I always do seem to glom onto subjects that fascinate me that also fascinate women. Last night, I was giving a reading, and somebody had discovered that the very first short story I sold ever, way back in 1985, had been to Cosmopolitan magazine. And she said, even then, when you were figuring out what to write and how to write, you know, you weren't exploring The New Yorker. You weren't exploring GQ. Something led you to try to sell work to Cosmopolitan first. And so I don't know what that I don't know quite what to make of that, but it is a reality. It is a reality.
Well,
yeah, you know, I find it interesting that I just finished a review for a newspaper of a new novel by Anita Shreve, and the very first sentence I wrote of the review was something to the effect of, you know, I read and enjoy novelist Anita Shreve's work, which is noteworthy only because I'm male and Shreve's books are conspicuously lacking in submarines.
I like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whenever I'm doing a pub, I was in Northampton, Massachusetts, a couple of nights ago, and there were about 120, 125 people there for the reading. It was a great, great crowd. And there weren't more than six men.
Well, it's not been a problem, you know? I mean,
well, I think if you subtract out Tom Clancy and The Da Vinci Code, that, you know, probably four out of every five novels that are purchased in this country are purchased by women.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, if you have to have an audience, if it's one or the other, probably having a female audience is the better of the two.
Yep.
Because, you know, the women are buying the books.
Yep.
For whatever reason. I mean, men are reading. I see men reading. What's up with that?
Pardon me?
I said men are reading. What are they reading?
Yeah. You know? I thought, you know, I guess a lot of John Grisham, a lot of John Krakauer, a lot of Tom Clancy. And incidentally, I love John Krakauer's work, too.
Yes, I do, too.
I think John Krakauer is fantastic.
Well, I'm curious too about this, and that is the legal stuff that goes on in your work. It's one thing I love about your books. You have legal battles. You have all this stuff with lawyers. This book has a handful of lawyers. They don't make it to the courtroom this time.
No.
Will you talk about that?
Sure. I do have a lot of lawyers in my books. Always. And this book has six attorneys in it, which is really, really wonderful if you like lawyers. But if you're a little squirrely about it, well, then I'll tell you that there are a lot of characters who aren't lawyers. But anyway, it does not end in a courtroom. It's interesting that a lot of my books that have lawyers don't build to the courtroom. Midwives, of course, does. And Water Witches builds to a development hearing, but not a courtroom. But The Law of Similars, it never gets to the courtroom. And in Before You Know Kindness, it never gets to the courtroom. In The Law of Similars, I thought it might. In Before You Know Kindness, I was pretty clear it wasn't. Where I thought it might go, and I don't want to reveal whether it does or doesn't get there, is to a press conference with some sort of amazing pyrotechnics occurring that surprises all the characters. The characters find themselves responding in ways that they hadn't anticipated. The great thing about lawyers is that even when they're not in a courtroom, is that they can be really cynical and really ironic. And cynical, ironic characters are fun to be around. Paige Sutherland is, I think, my favorite lawyer I've ever created. This, you know, sort of petite, you know, charming woman with a tam o' shanter wave in her hair. It's only when you get to know her that you realize she is a barracuda. And I have a great time with Paige Sutherland because she is a vegetarian, and she has great sympathy for animals, and she loves working with the fictional version of PETA as an outside counsel, but it kills her to have two attaché cases, one that's just nylon ballistic because she can't ever go to the feral offices with her leather attaché that she loves, or, you know, she has to give up this incredibly cool leather chair she got when she becomes a partner because you can't have leather in your office if you're representing feral. So, you know, she's conflicted. I think she's a real person, an interesting person, and, you know, there's a malpractice attorney who's a small cameo in the book, who's got a bronzed plaque he puts in his office, which has a quote from Shakespeare.
Yes.
When sorrows come, they come not spies, but in battalions. And I actually got that line when I was chatting with a lawyer I was interviewing for this particular book. He didn't have it in a plaque in his office. But he taught me two things that I thought were great. He taught me that, sort of the mantra of the malpractice attorney is that line from Shakespeare, when sorrows come, they come not as spies, but in battalions. And he taught me the expression, eat what you kill. That some law firms have the expression, the practice of you eat what you kill. In other words, you have a higher, you receive a higher proportion of the settlement than you might otherwise, with less going to the firm as an incentive to win. Not unlike the way the lion, eats what it kills.
Yes.
And I just love that, especially in the context of a book where animal rights figures so prominently.
Yeah, that's so great.
Yeah.
You are listening to Before You Know Kindness. I'm sorry, to Writers on Writing, and we're talking about Before You Know Kindness by Chris Bojalian, who is going to read to us again. Yes?
Sure, absolutely. I would love to. Okay, I'm going to read a short passage now from Chapter 1. And the reason I'm going to read this passage is because I want to introduce you to three of my favorite characters. The two girls, Willow, who is 10, Charlotte, who is 12, and their incredibly vigorous grandmother, Nan Seton, who is 70. This is from Chapter 1. The sun was up over Washington, Lafayette, and the trio of nearby cannonball-shaped mountains that recalled the Three Graces, and Nan Seton, elderly but far from frail, sat sipping her morning coffee on a chaise lounge on the Victorian house's wraparound porch. She noted how the sun was rising much later now than it had even 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was already the 28th or 29th of July, and her children would be arriving tomorrow, Friday. A golden retriever, old like her but not nearly so energetic, lolled near her feet on the outdoor rug. She had been on the porch close to half an hour, and even the coffee in the stovetop percolator she had brought outside with her was cold when she heard her granddaughters pound their way down the stairs. The older girl, Charlotte, was 12. The younger one, Willow, a name that drove grandmother crazy, both for its absolute lack of any family resonance and its complete new age inanity, was 10. The girls collapsed into the two wicker chairs near the outdoor table opposite their grandmother and her chaise. She saw they both had sleep in their eyes, and their hair wasn't brushed. They were still in their nightgowns, their feet were bare, and Charlotte was sitting in such a fashion, the sole of one foot wedged against her other leg's thigh, that her nightgown had bunched up near her waist, and she was offering anyone who cared to see an altogether indelicate and, in Nan's opinion, appalling show of flesh. "Good morning," she said to them, trying hard to resist the urge to put down her cup and saucer and pull Charlotte's nightgown back down over her knee. "How are my two little wildflowers?" "Sleepy," Charlotte said, her voice already the uninterested drawl of an urban teenager. "You girls are up early. Any special reason?" "There's a bird on the roof," Charlotte said. A woodpecker," Willow added, and she reached down to pet the dog. Nan nodded. She decided the bird must have been on the roof over the kitchen porch on the other side of the house, because otherwise she too would have heard him just now. "They don't normally drum this late in the season," she said to her granddaughters. "Trust me, we are not making this up," Charlotte said. "It sounds like there's some guy up there, and he's trying to open a tin of Altoids with a machine gun." The girl had two tiny hillocks starting to emerge on her chest, not yet breasts, and not visible in this particular nightgown, but they were evident in bathing suits and T-shirts. Her eyes were the shape of perfectly symmetrical almonds, her nose was small, and her mouth was a luscious pucker at once waif-like and impudent. She lacked her mother's paralyzingly sensual red hair, but her mane was thick and dark with natural hints of henna, and it fell on her shoulders like a cape. In a few years, Charlotte would be gorgeous, an absolute knockout. For the moment, however, she was in that murky world between childhood and serious adolescence. In one light, she might pass for 10. In another, she might be mistaken for 14. "She didn't say we were making anything up," Willow murmured, and then she did exactly what her grandmother wanted most in the world that very moment. She reached over to her cousin from Manhattan and pulled the older girl's nightgown down over her knee so that taut and tanned 12-year-old thigh once again was decently covered. "If I had a gun, I would have, shot it," Charlotte grumbled, widening her eyes as she spoke because she understood her remark was so gloriously inflammatory. But then, and here was that child, she still lacked the anarchic courage of a truly angry adolescent, and so she allowed herself a retraction of sorts. Well, not it, of course. Dad would, like, completely disown me if I ever did something like that. But maybe I would have shot near it, scared it, scared its beak off. Do you know why a woodpecker might drum in July, Nan asked them? Because it's an idiot. Charlotte, Willow began, but her cousin cut her off. It is. Why do you think we have the expression bird brain? And that is from the first chapter.
Thank you. It's wonderful to hear you read.
Well, thank you.
This book,
I will tell you, I'm not nearly as good as Blair Brown. Blair Brown reads the audio.
Oh, really?
Before, you know, kindness. Emmy Award-winning actor,
yes,
Blair Brown, you know, the days and life of Molly Todd, great Broadway performer.
Huh.
Anyway, I've had great readers on my books. I've had Kate Burton and Judith Ivey and David Burney, but I am Allison Fraser. But Blair Brown is just great.
Mm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful job.
Got to hear that. That was Chris Bojalian reading from Before You Know Kindness, his latest book. I am curious about you and your take on reading groups. On your website, which is chrisbojalian.com, you have a page, or actually a couple of pages, dedicated to reading groups.
I do.
Will you talk about that?
Yes,
why?
I love reading groups. And in fact, this is an offer I make at all my readings, and I'll make it here. If there are any reading groups that are reading one of my books and want me to chat with them via speakerphone or send me email questions, I'm always happy to schedule a speakerphone evening or answer questions by email. Just go to my website, chrisbojalian.com, and click on the Reading Groups tab. And the reason why I do that is because reading groups remind us of something we try to teach our preschool and elementary school-aged children all the time, but as grown-ups, we all too often tend to forget, and that is this. Reading is meant to be fun. It is capable of evoking from us the same conversational enthusiasm as movies and music and stage plays and the Dodgers and the Trojans and, you know, just if we only give the notion a chance. I have always had a great time with reading groups, and that's why I want to support them in any way that I can. And if it'll make the reading group more fun to, you know, have me rap with them via speakerphone for 30 minutes, or for me to take 20 minutes and answer some questions by email, I am honored to do it, and I always will do it.
Hmm. Yeah. It seems like these days there's just a million of them everywhere.
Yep.
Which is it's wonderful for so many reasons. And also, it's interesting too because publishers like reading groups at times more than I think bookstore events because they feel that reading groups have a more concentrated group of people who love the books as
yep.
opposed to doing things in bookstores and maybe having people come in, maybe not.
Yeah. Oh, I never have fun when I'm doing a straight bookstore signing, you know, where you sit at the table and you sign books as people come by.
Yes.
And I've had some of those events where there's been steady traffic for 2 and 3 hours, which is great, but it's never fun because people are standing in line and, or what's even worse is they're not standing in line because there's no sign of human habitation whatsoever. That happens too. Either way though, it's a lose-lose situation because either you're just not spending any time really talking about the book or getting your questions answered because you're keeping the line moving, or if you're the novelist, you're really, really bored, and you sit there feeling incredibly inadequate and like the world's biggest loser. Now, I do enjoy giving readings at bookstores or libraries or colleges. That's really fun. You read aloud for a bit, and then you answer questions. But the most fun experience of all are reading groups, and that's because you're talking about the book. And if you're an egomaniac the way I am, you're talking about your book. You know, obviously, we'll talk about other books, too. But it's just, you know, wonderful because you're talking about books and you're talking about literature and you're being really well-fed most of the time. I also know novelists who feel that reading groups, they denigrate reading groups because the readers drink while they're there, or they eat while they're there. And I once said to a friend of mine who feels this way and is a novelist, and I said, well, what do you want? He said, I want a seminar room. I want a really thick table, and I want them to argue. And I said, well, that's okay. All they right. can do that. But if I'm present, I want a really, really good Chardonnay.
Oh, dear. That's great. Well, I'm just so happy that you're into reading groups, and I hope people do visit your website, because it's also a wonderful website, and you're on there reading from your work, and all kinds of stuff is going on.
Thank you.
On it. We have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, just in terms of the business of writing and publishing, what about agents? I mean, do you at this point not need an agent? Because you're sort of along the way here with books and working with Shay Earhart Books.
Yep, Shay Earhart is my editor at Random House, and she's been my editor for 11 years, and she now has her own imprint at Random House, which is great. She's spectacular. She's not just a great editor, she's a great friend. So in that regard, I don't need an agent anymore because I've got a fabulous relationship with Random House. I've got a fabulous relationship with my editor. But, and here's an important but, here's what I still need agents for. I still need a dramatic rights agent in Beverly Hills or Los Angeles because I want someone in California representing my work for movies and television. And I still believe that an agent does a better job of selling foreign rights than the publisher. And that's because the agent has more invested in it. The person selling the foreign rights to the publisher is going to get a paycheck every week, regardless of whether he or she has any success selling the book overseas. The agent is only going to be paid when he or she closes the deal.
Yes.
So in that regard, I think I still encourage writers, even if they feel they don't need an agent for their U.S. book contracts, they certainly should consider it for dramatic rights in California and for foreign rights.
Do you think beginning writers or writers with, say, a first book that they have to market should find an agent or go directly to publishers?
No, they need to find an agent.
Yes.
It is impossible, I believe, to sell a novel now without an agent. And there are two reasons for that. The first reason is that editors are beleaguered. They have no time to breathe, and so they depend on agents to winnow down the slush pile on the assumption that an agent is only going to represent something if he or she thinks it is saleable, because they're only paid after the sale. So they only represent what's marketable, or just, even if it's not marketable, it is so important from a literary perspective that someone's got to buy into this just for the sake of future generations. So that's the first reason why, if you're a new writer, you must get an agent. The second reason you need one is because after 9/11, a lot of big houses don't even accept unsolicited manuscripts. You know, who knows what's going to be in there? It might not just be a bad book. It might be poison.
Yeah.
And while my first book, arguably, was more deadly than some weapons of mass destruction because it was so horrible. So the bottom line is, yes, if you're a new writer, you must get a literary agent.
Mm. Well, I have so appreciated talking to you again. And, I like your early work. So I don't know what you're talking about, but...
Barbara, thank you.
And your recent work is just excellent. So thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, it's always an honor to be on the show. And again, thank you for your faith in my work, and I congratulate you 1,000 times over on Pen on Fire.
Thank you.
You betcha.
Okay.
Good night.
That was Chris Bojalian, author of Before You Know Kindness. Wonderful, wonderful book. Gosh, I can't say enough about this one. Beautiful cover. I always talk about covers. No time to talk about that tonight, but I do hope you check it out. And if you would like to know more about Chris, his website is chrisbojalian.com, chrisbojalian.com. And if you want to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website, penonfire.com. This weekend, if you're in the San Diego area, I will be down there. I'm at Earth Song Books in Del Mar, so come by Saturday afternoon if you can. And I am going to leave you with a quote that's at the beginning of Chris's book, at the beginning of Before You Know Kindness, and it's by Naomi Shihab Nye, who said, "Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things, feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I won't be here next week. I'll have a guest host, but I will be here the last Thursday in October with T.C. Boyle. So I hope you're here next week for my guest host, and back again 2 weeks from tonight. Thanks so much for listening.